41, 42, 43, 44, 45, 46.
Hey, what you doing there, Dan? Counting the days to your retirement?
Oh, yeah, nice one. No, today marks the 46th episode of Negan and the Lone Ranger. Three seasons, very nearly 50 episodes. Quite an accomplishment for a podcast that some people thought was completely and utterly politically incorrect.
Well, I mean, we've done a good job of showing people that the Lone Ranger is actually a pretty progressive character. So, honestly, the fact that we're still going is, I think, proof that we've turned public opinion in our favor.
Well, I think we'll be back again in the fall. And when we launch the next season, I have one guest that I will make sure that we get on the pod.
Is it – could it be?
Yep. Pierre Poilievre, leader of the Federal Conservative Party. We've interviewed every federal leader, including Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, but not Poilievre.
Well, not yet. But I mean, I don't know, Dan. I'm really not sure if he's ever actually going to do our podcast.
Well, it's true. Poilievre is riding high in the polls. And, you know, when politicians and their parties are riding high in the polls, you know, they don't need us. They don't need to do podcast interviews. But right before an election campaign starts, the window opens up and all leaders and parties suddenly become our best buddies.
Or we could wait until Trudeau and the Liberals narrow the gap with the Tories, and then he might need us sooner, right?
Oh, man. You're hilarious.
Nico, that's funny.
Wait, you're serious, aren't you? Oh, poor Negan. Poor Negan.
The Winnipeg Free Press proudly presents, in partnership with CJNU 93.7 FM, Negan and the Lone Ranger. Here are your hosts, Negan Sinclair and Dan the Lone Ranger Lett.
Welcome everybody to, as you've already heard, the 46th episode of Negan and the Lone Ranger.
Not that anybody except you is counting, Dan.
Well, actually, I only know because Negan counted.
I did text.
Okay, that's fair. Actually.
So it wasn't me originally. It would have been nice to finish off the season on a round number like 50, but, you know, manure happens, as they say in the podcast world.
They say that in the podcast world?
Well, they do now.
They do now.
Yeah, that's right. But you know, like, God and the Free Press willing, we'll be back, again in the fall, or else you're going to be, everybody who's listening to this podcast is going to be contacted about a pending GoFundMe campaign.
unless,
yeah,
you know, it's hard not to get right into the news because it turns out that about 2 weeks ago, they discovered an asteroid sort of screaming towards the space in between the Earth and the Moon. MK2024 will pass roughly 290,000 kilometers from Earth by the time you're listening to this, but it's safe. Everything's fine. This was a big asteroid.
I was going to say, you know, thanks, because there was a gap. I have like eight things that keep me awake at night, but normally it's not. So I had an opening for something else to keep me awake at night.
Thanks for that. While it is quite alarming that it did kind of come out of nowhere.
And quite close.
And it is about the size of two or three football fields. It is fine. Everything is fine, everybody. What they have learned a lot from this discovery, that they have a bit of a blind spot over there in NASA. And they've discovered
this just gets better and better.
It takes the discovery of a blind spot to realize you have a blind spot.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm feeling an urgent need to reach out and make sure that I know where Bruce Willis is right now, in case we need to send some people.
With all respect to his family, he is kind of ill these days.
No, that's true. But we, you know, listen, if you're looking for someone to land on the asteroid and blow it up, I could be part of that.
You could do that. I mean, I could do that too. I could be the Steve Buscemi character that goes nuts on the asteroid as it's screaming through the sky.
No, I never thought I would invoke Donald Rumsfeld on this podcast, but this feels like NASA are dealing with known unknowns and unknown knowns.
Okay, so the reason I bring that up is because, as we are taping this, we are in the wake of another thing screaming towards us, which was the U.S. presidential election debate that was last night. It was I think, worse than an asteroid hitting us.
Well, I do believe – I mean, there's so often the episodes in our lives right now, I believe, should have an REM soundtrack. You know, it's the end of the world as we know it. If we could scrape together the money to pay the royalties, I suppose we could even use that as our new, you know, theme song. But anyways
– Michael Stipe would be delighted.
You know, Biden really wanted the debates. Biden and the Democrats really wanted the debates. And then he showed up and what's the technical term? Oh, yeah. He shit the bed. You know what? I'm going to ask. Do not bleep that in our 46th episode.
This could be our first moment where we don't bleep it.
Oh, yeah. He shit the bed.
You know, Biden was sort of predicted by the Trump world to show up. They're alleging a whole bunch of things that he would be upped up on drugs or whatever they've decided.
Yeah.
Because historically he's done well in debates. He's incisive, certainly on task. He likes to be combative. This was something completely out of the – I mean, perhaps in the norm. Maybe he's been shielded up to this point, but his health is clearly impacting him. They say that he had a flu that he could not for some reason or another focus. But – it did not in any way encourage, regardless of what he said, which was to try to dispel the plethora, the Lilapalooza of lies that Donald Trump just dumped in every second that he spoke.
So here's the new standard for how do I know if I lost a debate? I lost a debate when a guy who's been convicted of 34 felonies goes out of his way to make a big fuss about how my son was convicted of a felony. So if Trump feels confident that he can smear someone else as being a felon, but feels that none of it blows back on him, then I'm not sure that there's any sense left in this election campaign.
Trump pulled, I guess, a Bill Clinton-ish moment where he said, "I did not have sex with the porn star," where, I mean, the whole reality is that the court trial maybe didn't prove that he did this, but certainly that he paid for it to not come here to the public. And so anyways, just if we were to go through all of the different falsehoods that Donald Trump said in that debate, we would be here for 3-4 hours, just recounting, dispelling. We could spend a whole season just dealing with just the last night's debate.
So the underlying sort of inside baseball / politics issue here is that, you know, for the last year or more, people have been not just Republicans. A lot of people have been wondering about Joe Biden's shelf life. And, you know, I think it's like when you have two guys in their late 70s running to be president. You know,
Joe Biden, I think, 81 this point.
Oh, my God. So, you know, like it's not – I'm not saying that somebody who's 81 can't be president. I'm saying I'm not sure this guy can. But the point is that politically it's so hard to become a leader and then as the leader of a party to become elected to lead a government. It's really, really hard. And the people who do that are not people who lack self-confidence. They do quite often lack self-awareness. And when, you know, people are saying, you know, all things being equal, you know, if you, once again, technical term, shit the bed in this campaign, you're going to put the country into the hands of a madman for another 4 years. Like maybe you should actually think about what they're saying, which is the dovetail to the, hey, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, are you really listening to what the people around you are saying right now?
So we have been it's hard not to get caught up in the story. And so the big obsession with the Canadian media has been for weeks, and arguably on this podcast, we've talked a little. When we had Justin Trudeau on our podcast, we asked him directly in the final question that we asked, would you stay? How committed to you are staying? With the Toronto, St. Paul's by-election, going not the Liberal way, safest riding, one of the safest ridings you could imagine is sort of the barrier of Toronto that the Liberals have held on to for forever. They've lost that seat now. It's evident that there's a growing momentum movement towards Trudeau that's tangible. It's not just something that can be said in polls, which can or may or may not be right and can be easily criticized. The reality is that the country, a large majority of the country, is certainly uncomfortable with Justin Trudeau. And now what you're seeing is within the Liberal Party, real stalwart Liberals. And Catherine McKenna, which I think I would imagine over the years that there are a few people who appeared more beside Justin Trudeau, other than his wife, other than real staunch, dedicated Liberals. I mean, Catherine McKenna is as liberal as you can get.
And also, I think universally, you know, maybe not in a partisan world, but in a nonpartisan world, respected as quite a competent minister for the time that she was there with Trudeau.
First Minister of the Environment, Climate Change back in 2015, and, you know, was a very staunch supporter of Justin Trudeau for a long time, defender, and has come out and said that the Liberal Party needs a change. And it is hard not to compare this to the United States, where we see just absolute incompetency in almost every range on whether which party we're talking about. And now a discussion of whether Trudeau in the north here in above the medicine line in, here in Canada, that whether he's capable of leading the Liberal Party. I mean, I think one thing that's evident is that he said on our podcast that he is staunchly committed, but maybe the Toronto-St. Paul by-election may change that commitment. I am still willing to bet that his entire legacy, his chips in the middle, are on this federal election coming up next year. And he really believes that. And if you look to his personal life and his professional life, I think he really sees this as something he's going to stake all of his claim on going forward.
Yeah. I mean, there's a very fine line between being committed to your job, wanting to do a good job, believing that you're the best person for the job, and ignoring, you know, circumstances when they gang up on you. The point is now that the only real narrative around Justin Trudeau is, when is he going to leave? Is he going to leave? Is there any possibility that he'll step down?
He's very similar to his father. I mean, way back in 1980s, remember the famous walk in the snow? The Pierre Trudeau legacy became at the very end days, not what he's doing or what his ideas are, but when are you leaving?
And again, this is where the great flaw, self-awareness is so important for leaders. It really is. The great flaw in that quality of self-awareness is, if you don't have it, how would you know? I also think too that political leadership, this is just my own metric for assessing the quality of political leadership, is whether or not a leader surrounds him or herself with strong people and that those strong people are listened to. So if there is no one close to Trudeau right now who is telling him that he has utterly and completely become the problem and that he is no longer the solution, no matter whether he thinks he's the solution, other people don't think he's the solution. If there is nobody around him telling him that right now, shame on them. If there are people telling him that and he's not listening, then shame on him.
And so it would be worth watching in the next few days. I think it's hard not to look at this incredible, almost dumpster fire in the United States of a U.S. election that's just unbelievable and just baffling. But then also look at the inside ranks within the kind of barbecue circuit. So now we're in the summer stage. The parliament is no longer sitting. You'll see this kind of movement in liberal circles as to whether they'll circle around a new leader. Perhaps McKenna will be one of them. Maybe there will be somebody else. Chrystia Freeland comes to mind. Whether there will be another person that will step up and start to take the energy of the Liberal Party in a certain direction, or whether they will just batten down the hatches with Trudeau and he'll get it. He does have a very close network. I mean, Mark Miller, Seamus O'Regan, you know, all these kinds of individuals who have been stuck with him for a very long period of time. There's a lot of Liberals, I think, that will go with him to the very end of however far he goes. But the question will be is whether another voice will step up, and maybe this was the tipping point.
Well, in recent Manitoba history, Brian Pallister was determined to stay and fight another election. in 2021. And then a bunch of people in the party rose up and said, look, if you want this to become an out and out civil war, like if you want to be pitted against others in the party in a very public way, then just keep going the way you're going. If you don't, then make your excuses and step aside.
One thing about that thing is that we in the media love that. Or we certainly have a lot of ability to write about that.
Okay, so I know that I will be criticized by all sides on by saying this, but I miss him. I mean, like you're talking about a guy who, like, I just every time he held a news conference or did something, I was left agog
with something to write about.
It was just What? It's like, I just remember, like, whenever he did a news conference during the pandemic, all I was doing was I was emailing his staff going, fact check on that, please. Where did that come from? When did that happen? You know, like, it was certainly kept us on our toes. You know what? Like, I do have empathy for political leaders. I think it's an incredibly tough job. And I think your shelf life, you know, like the shelf life of an average political leader in Canada is less than an offensive lineman in the NFL. You know, like if you could get 8 years without CTE and other things setting in, you know, it's the same thing in politics, you know.
If you can, I mean, the reality is that if you can keep unity in your party, you really are a politician of special note. I mean, we only see those kind of once a generation. I think Gary Doer is one. You might say Filmon would be another one, you know, in Manitoba. I think Justin Trudeau has been for a while been able to keep a strong sense of unity. I certainly have not seen ministers come out publicly and say anything. That's the thing that's really been said is that the caucus is a tight ship. And the really only other notable ejection would have been Jody Wilson-Raybould and Jane Philpott. And that was a number of years ago now. And to see this, I think, is a real tipping point. So we'll see. Which brings us to, I think, a much more controversial subject, Canada's finances.
Do you want to know something fascinating? One of the names that has been linked to the Liberal leadership is former Bank of Canada Governor Mark Carney.
Kismet.
And that brings us to our feature interview for this week, which I wasn't able to attend. I've been dealing with a death in our family. But you very capably handled and organized this great interview with Tiff Macklem, who is the governor of the Bank of Canada and, you know, probably deals with one of the most hardest issues coming out of the pandemic, which is how does Canada bounce back in this crisis, which has often been called an interest rate crisis or an affordability crisis?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting opportunity. As you'll hear in the interview, I reached out to the Bank of Canada not expecting to get an interview with Tiff Macklem, but wanting somebody to assure me that I wasn't stark raving mad. For I had suggested rather foolishly, as it turns out, that you know inflation was a global phenomenon brought on by the pandemic, supply chain, global conflict, and a precipitous increase in the price of oil. And, you know, readers flocked readers flocked to tell me what a frickin' moron I was, because clearly inflation was a creation of the Trudeau government.
I was going to say.
Carbon tax and this enduring image of, that gets floated all the time online about how, the Bank of Canada at Prime Minister's instruction printed more money to fund pandemic stimulus programs, and that led to inflation. That makes a lot of sense in one perverted corner of the
I was going to say, if you're flying a certain flag at the back of your truck, maybe.
But anyway, so, in all fairness, even though I think it's hokum, I talked to the Bank of Canada governor about the causes of inflation. And he had some interesting things to say, and including, I wish to direct listeners to pay attention to what he said about opportunistic inflation, because I also think that it's a very strong comment. So anyways, onwards and upwards with interview with Bank of Canada Governor Tiff Macklem. At this stage in the political debate in Canada, we hear a lot of things about monetary policy, probably more about monetary policy in today's political and economic environment than ever before. And some of that has to do with the seismic impacts of pandemic, global conflict, inflation, and its impact on interest rates, and which impacts everybody. But you know, the amount of discussion, the detail of the discussion is, at least in the humble opinion of the host, somewhat unprecedented. And I'm someone who has had an interest in monetary policy, if only because if I'm ever asked to talk about it, I'd like to know something about what it is that I'm talking about. We're fortunate right now that the governor of the Bank of Canada, Tiff Macklem, is, I don't know, would you call it an unprecedented national tour, barnstorming of the country? How would you discuss or describe the traveling that you're doing right now, and the, you know, to bring the message and perhaps some sanity to our understanding of monetary policy?
Well, Dan, you're right that there is an unusually high interest in monetary policy around the country. Inflation has been higher than it's been for 40 years. And 2 years ago, we raised rates rapidly. Those decisions are affecting the everyday lives of Canadians. And so, yes, there is an unprecedented interest. Actually, you know, traveling across the country is not new. If you look back, governors regularly gave speeches, met with businesses, met with labor groups, met with Canadians across the country. It is true that we have expanded somewhat our outreach efforts. I think at this time in particular, it's important that we listen to Canadians. We meet face to face and get their perceptions, understand the decisions they're facing. And at the same time, we do our very best to explain the decisions we're taking and why we're taking them, and demonstrating that we understand the impact that it's having on Canadians.
I think, and these will be my words, of course, not yours, but I think that there are some very bold assumptions being made about monetary policy and the influence that the Bank of Canada and or the federal government has on what's happening in the world. That you mentioned high inflation and the high interest rates. I think most people understand that high interest rates follow high inflation as a monetary strategy. But I think that there's probably less understanding about the origins of inflation in our current economy. If you, what's the elevator pitch on inflation, that we hope won't get you or me into some sort of trouble with, you know, the forces that would dispute us?
Actually, I don't think it's that complicated. And I actually think Canadians do understand inflation pretty intuitively. The basic explanation is, if demand is running ahead of the capacity of businesses to produce the goods and services people want to buy, prices go up. When there's a lot more goods and services around than people want to buy, what a businesses, retailers, well, they start discounting, they start cutting prices to move that inventory out. So you know that works one store at a time, and if you add it all up, it works for the whole economy.
So. There are alternate theories, however, floating out there. And I think I related a story to you that I had inadvertently offered a very similar explanation of inflation, global conflict, supply chain problems, pandemic, the escalation of wages in certain industries that found in the later stage of the pandemic, it was so difficult to get people to work on the front lines of some, you know, air transportation, retail, hospitality, all these things driving. And what happened was, not surprising, I had Milton Friedman thrown back in my face about 1,000 times in a 3 or 4 day period. And the quote, of course, is, you know, that it is always in inflation is always in everywhere a monetary phenomena, which has been cited as a rallying cry for people who have accused you personally and the bank in general of instigating inflation in Canada. Now, I'm not, I just for listeners, I'm not buying that. I didn't buy it then. I certainly don't buy it now that I have the governor of the Bank of Canada in front of me. But where does that come from? Where does this Friedman-esque, you know, this attempt to fit what's happening now into, you know, some very venerable economic observations?
Look, at one level, Milton Friedman is right. I mean, people need money to spend. So when you say there's spendings running ahead of the ability of the economy to produce the goods and services that people want to buy, yes, if people are spending that money more than the economy can produce it, that's going to cause inflation. So yes, money and inflation are linked. I think though what we've learned over time is that that link is not very precise. In fact, the Bank of Canada, like many central banks, had in the 1970s targets for monetary aggregates, M1 targeting. We targeted money, and that was very much in the spirit of Milton Friedman. If we control the growth of money, we could control inflation.
And by the growth of money, you mean the supply of money?
The supply of money, yes. Yep. What we found, though, was that it failed miserably. Because the relationship between money, income, and inflation was not stable. And so in 1981, the Bank of Canada abandoned monetary targeting, or as the then governor famously said, we didn't abandon monetary targeting, it abandoned us. And actually that, in some ways, was kind of the precursor to what eventually led to inflation targeting. Because the failure of monetary targeting, money was really an intermediate target to try to target inflation, but it didn't work. So the Bank of Canada dropped that and in 10 years later announced an inflation target. We're going to target the thing, our ultimate objective. Our objective is to control inflation. Let's target that and let's use our policy instrument, the interest rate, to achieve the inflation target. And that has been very successful. We do monitor money growth. We do monitor credit growth. Those are things that, they give windows into people's spending and people's behavior. But ultimately, we target inflation, and you know, you can't rely month to month, even year to year, on the relationship between money and inflation.
The fundamental misunderstanding about the Bank of Canada's role in helping, first of all, helping government respond to the impact of the pandemic, and then later on the steps that you had to take to try and control inflation, there hinges on this allegation that Bank of Canada was madly printing additional money so the government could give it away to people who parenthetically, a lot of the suggestions been made that they didn't deserve it, but all this money flooded into the economy. And that's what created the additional demand. And I am a little embarrassed to ask this question after doing the research, but I'm going to ask it anyways. So did you print a whole bunch of extra money to flood the economy, like to work in hand with the government on its pandemic stimulus?
Well, look, a couple of points. First of all, this image is of us with a giant printing press in the bottom of the Bank of Canada, it's a lovely metaphor and it gives a beautiful image, but that's not the way monetary policy works. Our primary instrument is our policy interest rate. And very early in the pandemic, the Bank of Canada lowered the policy interest rate to effectively zero. You can't lower it any lower. So yes, we did use an exceptional tool add more monetary policy stimulus. And that is what's commonly known as quantitative easing. So we created extra high-powered central bank money. The second, and the way you want to think about that is it's a different way of lowering interest rates. We couldn't lower our overnight policy interest rate, the one-day interest rate, the thing we control, but by buying government bonds in large quantities, we pulled down the yields on government bonds at 5 years, at 10 years. Those are the terms that people actually borrow at. When you get a mortgage, you typically get a 5-year mortgage. So we pulled down the 5-year mortgage rate, to try to help everybody get through this enormous crisis. You have to keep in mind, you know, my first day as governor, June 3rd, 2020, GDP in the economy was minus 15%. The unemployment rate was 14%. There was another, you know, 3 million Canadians were unemployed. Another 2 million were working less than their normal hours. The economy was in crisis. Inflation was actually slightly negative. Our big concern was we needed to avoid deflation and get this economy back on its feet. It worked. Yes, it's been bumpy coming out, and I'm not saying we got everything exactly right, but that exceptional stimulus, it got us out of that very deep hole. It was the deepest recession on record. It was the fastest recovery on record.
Are you not a little bit concerned, and this isn't concerned about whatever party is in government right now, but concerned that that this has become part of the political debate? In people who are pointing fingers at the current federal government are accusing them of causing inflation or exacerbating it, and they're making the Bank of Canada complicit in that. Does that worry you at all, that that's become embedded as part of the political narrative?
So let me be really clear on the first point. Our decisions have always been entirely guided by our mandate to control inflation. At the beginning of the pandemic, as I said, inflation was actually slightly negative. We were very concerned about deflation. Deflation has devastating effects on an economy. We wanted to avoid deflation. We wanted to get inflation back up to the target. Obviously, since 2022, inflation went way above the target. We've been working for the last 2 years to get it back down. But all those decisions to cut interest rates, to use quantitative easing, to end quantitative easing, to raise rates extremely rapidly, and most recently we've dropped our rate 25 basis points to 4.75. All those decisions have been taken independent of governments, guided by our inflation control mandate. What doesn't concern me, and which actually I think is healthy, is there is a lot more discussion about monetary policy in Canada. And that really reflects the fact that people, you know, a whole new generation of Canadians have unfortunately learned just how painful inflation is. And they're dealing with the consequences of a rapid increase in interest rates. It's affecting their lives. They're asking, you know, they're reaching out to their elected representatives. And so there is more commentary. There is more discussion. And actually, that is a good thing. These are important decisions. There should be discussion. We've been asking ourselves, you know, we've been getting a lot of hard questions from Canadians, and we should be. We've been asking ourselves hard questions. What does concern me, though, is when elected officials give us direct instructions that, you know, we should do this, we should do that. I do worry that that could create the perception in the minds of Canadians that monetary policy is not independent of the government. And I do think that that's unfortunate. There's a reason why central banks have independence to conduct monetary policy. And you know, to come back where you started earlier in the interview, you want to have the ability to create money separate from the spending of the money. There's a reason, if you look around most economies in the world, the central bank is set up independent of government. That independence is really important, and it's most important when the decisions are difficult. And the decisions have been difficult in the last few years.
I'm not, you know, I don't want to be positioned to dispute the impact of inflation. Although, you know, I do remember my mother holding a mortgage at 14% in a previous age. And thankfully, we're nowhere near that. I do, however, have this strong feeling, and I think some of it is borne out by where interest rates were at prior to this period of unprecedentedly low interest rates, this extended period. The very first house I bought, we had a 4.25 percent mortgage, and it was around 2000, and we were happy to have it. We thought it was very competitive, and we quickly managed our money to cover those costs. I think the highest I ever got was 5.15. I guess the point I'm trying to make is I take a look at the mortgage rates today, and I know it's just one metric, but has there been some alarmist language around the impact of inflation? There's no doubt that it's hitting some people very hard, but is it hitting us hard because we learned to live with cheap money for so long? Is that where the whiplash comes? Because it doesn't seem to me that the actual interest rates are, on a historic basis, all that high.
Well, Dan, you got to distinguish between inflation and interest rates. Look, I think there is no doubt when we had inflation in 2002 at 8%, food price inflation at 11%, rents going up quickly, that was severely impacting Canadians, and it disproportionately affects lower income Canadians. If most of your budget is buying necessities, they're necessities. It's hard to cut back on necessities. Mm-hmm. It's hard to cut. You got to pay your rent. You're already shopping very carefully. There's not much opportunity to cut your food expenditure. Mm-hmm. And obviously lower income Canadians, they have smaller buffers. They have less savings to dip into. So they're really squeezed when inflation goes up. And that's one of the reasons why it's so important to keep inflation down. Coming back to interest rates, you're right that before the global financial crisis in 2007, 2008, 4 to 5% interest rate was a very normal interest rate. We did have a dozen years from the global financial crisis in 07, 08 to 2019, when the 2020, when the pandemic hit. We had roughly, a dozen years there where interest rates were unusually low. There were a number of reasons for that. And one of the things, we've been stressing, look, we don't have a crystal ball. We don't know where interest rates are going. And keep in mind, interest rates are the instrument we use. They are our tool to control inflation. So interest rates are going to go where they need to go to control inflation. But it does seem unlikely that we're going back to the very low interest rates we had pre-pandemic. So that means there is an adjustment. There's an adjustment for households. There's an adjustment for businesses. There's an adjustment for governments. Governments borrow a lot. So, that is something that we're all going to get used to. I think there is scope for interest rates to come down from where they are. As we've said, if the economy evolves broadly as we expect, if we continue to see inflationary pressures easing, it's reasonable to expect further declines in interest rates. But I think, getting back to where we were pre-COVID, that doesn't look like the most likely outcome on interest rates.
With inflation, and you mentioned the major pressure points, I'm wondering, I know it's a complex calculus, trying to figure out why the price of any one thing that we're relying upon goes up. But there certainly has been lots of analysis and discussion, especially things like rents and food in particular. Has there been opportunism though as well? I think that's the concern a lot of people have, particularly in food, is that you can't really track back the increase in food and connect it, the magnitude of it, to the inflationary forces that were being faced by the people that produce the food and move the food and sell the food. Do you think there's been some opportunism? And then the second question would be, do you think we're ever really going to know how food prices got to be as high as they were at the peak of inflation?
The short answer is yes, and I think it's broader than food. I think it's pretty generalized in the economy. What we saw... So when inflation is low and stable, there's a lot of pressure on companies not to raise their prices because they're going to lose customers. They're very nervous about raising their prices because when prices are low and stable, you raise your price, that stands out. And customers think, well, okay, you know, this store has raised its price, I'm going to another store. But the problem with inflation is that when everybody's raising their prices and you're the consumer, there's nowhere to go. Mm-hmm. You just got to pay those prices. And so, and we could see this in the data. The frequency and size of price increases across many sectors of the economy went up considerably when inflation went up. Companies weren't feeling that competitive pressure to not increase their prices. So yes, we did see a change in behavior. And interestingly, as inflation has come back down, that pressure now to be more cautious about raising your prices, that's coming down. And we're seeing the pricing behavior of companies start to get back to something that looks more normal.
Yeah, I mean, there was such a crush for a period of time trying to buy new cars. And the prices, because I was one of those people, and it was outrageous the way prices went up. Recently, I think we've seen huge discounts and huge incentives being offered again, and interest rates that are lower than market rates because people stop buying new cars. So it's nice to know that still works on the back end. Do you think, like, how important for us is it to get a clear analysis of all this? Like, to be able to identify how much of this was driven, as you say, by the ability to raise prices because everybody was doing it. And, you know, it wasn't impacting consumer behavior right away. Is it important that we, you know, that we're able to definitively say what happened?
Well, I think certainly from the Bank of Canada's point of view, it's really important that we understand how the inflation process changes when inflation goes up a lot. I mean, we had 30 years of pretty low, stable inflation in the grander scheme of things. You know, we didn't have 7-8% inflation for the last 30 years. And so when you look at our empirical relationships, our models, they're based on the assumption that pricing behavior was pretty normal. One of the reasons why we underestimated just how rapidly inflation went up was that the whole behavior changed. And so when you get outside of normal, yes, you know, what you see is that companies' behavior changes. And I think this only reinforces, you know, why keeping inflation, you know, reasonably grounded, keeping it in some sort of normal range is really important.
So, I'm going to kind of ask you questions about where you think we're headed, although your comments, A, about making predictions being, you know, maybe not the smartest thing that anybody can do right now, but also you did get flack for making certain predictions about interest rates. So I just want to ask you, when you made the statements about how you didn't think interest rates were going to go up, what was that based on? Like, I because I think it's easy to kind of jump, you know, on people for having said those things. But, you know, some of the people I rely upon to understand these things, like Nate Silver, you know, he's assured me that no one has ever accurately predicted a recession. There are people who've said it was going to happen and people who said it wasn't going to happen. But these things are beyond the scope of really trying to predict. So what was going on when you made those comments?
What was going on when I made those comments was the economy was in crisis. You know, as I said, you know, unemployment rate was over 14%. GDP was roughly 15%. This is like the deepest plummet in GDP we've ever had in this country. We were deeply concerned that we weren't just going to have a recession. We were going to have a depression. You know, at the beginning of the pandemic, nobody knew when a vaccine was going to be available. Nobody knew how many waves there were going to be. Certainly, you know, talking to the epidemiologists, what they were telling us was, you know, the first wave is probably not the biggest wave. Turns out they were right about that. There's going to be subsequent waves. So when we looked at the economy, what we thought was, look, we've got to do everything we can to put a floor under this. That's what we did. Now, the good news is, you know, together with the, you know, the incredibly rapid introduction of new vaccines, exceptional fiscal policy combined with exceptional monetary policy, the economy recovered you know, we had various scenarios. What actually happened was like the best scenario we'd contemplated in our forecasts. It was about the most rapid recovery we had within our scenarios. So, you know, we're then faced with pulling out as quite rapidly a lot of the stimulus we'd put in place. You know, look, interest rates actually, you know, people seem to have forgotten this, but, you know, interest rates actually were close to zero for 2 years. You know, we started raising in March 2022, 2 years after the start of the pandemic. So that actually is quite a long time for interest rates to be at zero. Certainly, you look back in history, it's extremely unusual. Look, what we didn't expect and what nobody saw coming really was how rapidly inflation would go up coming out of the pandemic and the need to raise rates very rapidly to well above where they'd been pre-pandemic. So yes, you know, we were surprised by how rapidly inflation went up. And, you know, we had to adjust to that. And I think the fact that we moved forcefully, we moved rapidly, as difficult as that have been, it would have been worse if we hadn't. Inflation would still be higher. We'd still be raising interest rates. We wouldn't be cutting them if we had not moved forcefully at the outset.
I think that that is a major point that is lost in the disciples of Friedman when, you know, that they start to attack the current government and the Bank of Canada for steps taken to deal with the pandemic is what would have happened if those steps weren't taken. In your mind, though, there was nothing that government or the Bank of Canada did during that period of time that directly on its own provoked inflation.
I mean, look, if you're asking me, did we get everything right? No, we did not get everything right. You know, this was an unprecedented situation. Yes, we were surprised how rapidly inflation went up coming out of the pandemic. You know, a lot of this had to do with global supply chains were very gummed up. And I think we demand surged at the same time that supply was still gummed up. I think it is true. We underestimated that interaction and that did create a surge in inflation. I mean, there were some other things. Obviously, Russia's unprovoked attack of Ukraine created a big increase in global oil prices, global food prices that you know made a difficult situation a lot worse. Those things are unforecastable. But yes, there are some things that you know, with the benefit of hindsight, I wish we could have done better. I think, you know, we are working to take those lessons on board. I think it is important to reflect on the pandemic response. In fact, we are conducting a full review of our pandemic response. My colleague Sharon Kazicki previewed some of the results of that in a speech a couple of weeks ago, and there's more to come. That work is still underway. It is important that we review this experience and we extract the lessons from it. So if something like this happens again, we're better prepared.
So yeah, it's the most unfair question based on this part of the conversation. But what is the best assumption or image of the future from this point? Like, I know that you've been very careful not to promise that interest rates are coming down to pre-pandemic levels. You've been very careful not to actually get us to expect that interest rates are going to come down like clockwork, that you're watching the situation very carefully. But where do you think we're headed as a country and an economy?
Well, I think if you look out over the next year, as you said, I don't have a crystal ball any more than you do. But, you know, when we look at the economy, what do we see? Well, we see inflation has been steadily coming down. And when you look at the near-term dynamics inflation, it looks like unless there's something new that happens, that's likely to continue. At the same time, you know, growth in the economy, which was very weak in the second half of last year, effectively zero, growth in the first quarter picked up. It's not strong, but was solid. And over the course of the year, we expect to see growth gradually pick up. So the scenario is looking reasonably good. Inflation, we expect, is gradually going to tick down further towards our 2% target. Growth is going to gradually pick up. And I think the message is, look, we've been through a very difficult period. This has been a difficult monetary cycle, getting inflation down. It has been painful. We're not through it yet, mm-hmm. but we're starting to come out the other side.
It was funny when I was reading the prepare for the interview, my eyes glanced at a story in the New York Times about Russia threatening the United States with retaliation for the Ukraine using U.S. U.S. weapons in a recent attack. And it made me think 2007, 2008, 2019, 2020. As you said, the next big thing that may determine what direction we're headed is something that we're not going to see coming. Is that kind of the rule of thumb moving forward?
Well,
if there's likely to be some sort of seismic,
there are. You know, if you read what we put out, we talk about the risks that we can see that could happen and what those could mean for monetary policy, but. Yes, unfortunately, you know, history's replete of examples of things that came completely out of the blue. Mm-hmm. And you can prepare for those in the sense that you can make sure that you're well organized if you have a crisis. Mm-hmm. Then you're going to have the people and the processes and the systems to deal with it. I mean, it's a bit like, you know, think of an earthquake. You can't predict earthquakes. You can't prevent earthquakes, but you can build your buildings to a certain code resistance to withstand the earthquake. You can make sure you've got a good emergency protocol. So if people are injured, there's ambulance that come to get them, and there's doctors are ready to deal with the wounded, and there's nurses on staff who can come in quickly to do that. Well, You can think of monetary policy. It's a bit like that. We don't know what's going to happen, but we need to make sure that you know, we've got the systems and the tools and the talent to deal as best we can with if there is something that comes out of the blue.
Thank you very much for this. It is the number of interviews and public events and everything you're doing. This is not easy work. I think it is valuable work, and we certainly appreciate the fact that the Bank of Canada's traveling summer roadshow decided to make a stop with us. Thank you very much for your time, and we'll be watching to see what the future brings.
Well, thanks, Dan. It's a real pleasure to be here. I'm in Winnipeg for a couple of days, and I'm going to soak it all up. So thanks very much for having me.
Not the longest interview that we've ever done, but man, oh man, that was dense.
Very enlightening.
A lot of stuff packed in there. But there was also, before we started the interview formally, there was a great moment, really kicked off actually by our compadre, Adam Glynn, who asked the question that I wish I'd asked during the podcast, but we did get his answer. So
for a little bit of inside baseball on the podcast, whenever we have a guest come into the studio, I try and throw them what I feel will be the easiest question of the day, just to get their levels on the mics and that kind of thing. So I asked Tiff Macklem, does it ever feel weird seeing your signature on banknotes? Because the governor of the Bank of Canada is the signature
probably
on the banknote.
Probably the most burning question I think anyone
right?
Ask
but he gave a really, really fair account of himself. And we were talking about this. And by the time we turned the tape on to start recording, we were asking him, you know,
serious
kind
questions.
Of semi-serious yeah. questions. But here's where the thread kind of went.
You ever look at it and go, I could have done it better.
Yeah, you always look at your signature and think, I could have done it better, but there you know, it's your signature.
Anytime I have to sign an official document, like you get your new passport, and it's like, okay, now you need to sign it, I look at it and I go,
I'm going to screw this up.
Well, they do give you more than one. Like you can
sign a bunch.
You can sign a bunch and pick your favorite one. It's okay. Not like signing your passport. You got one shot at it.
That's good.
The only tricky bit is there's this little box you get, and you have to keep your signature in the box. So you can't just sort of go, because you got to keep it in the little box. But other than that, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know what I find hilarious is, and I didn't get a chance to ask him, it's like, so if you sign and it goes outside the box, is that it? Like, are you done as Bank of Canada governor? Like, you know, like, oh, that's,
is it,
yeah.
Is it faulty? Is it a default on all the money, or does it make the money worthless?
Thanks, Tiff. We really wish it had worked out. But, you know, if you can't sign within the box, you're clearly not the right guy for the job.
So, so for those of you who go to those, like the passport is the one that rings the bell most for me, but there's lots of forms out there that you, when you get really frustrated, you got to fit in that box. Know that Governor of the Bank of Canada has to do that too.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, hey, and listen, I have a big flourish on the D on my signature.
Hang on a minute.
I'm very discriminated against.
Are you trying to tell us that you've got a big D?
Okay, that's an all new low on episode 46 of the podcast.
No, I'm going to have to, yeah. On that note, we wrap up the 46th episode.
And season three.
Season three comes to its end.
Season three comes to its end. And as I said, God and the Free Press willing, we'll be back in the fall. You know, we'll have a presidential election. I already know that former U.S. Ambassador and Manitoba Premier Gary Doer is clamoring to get back on the show. Excellent. He heard there was a T-shirt.
Would that be the third visit?
That would be his third visit.
That will make him a friend of the podcast. No, hey, my sisters, who I'm spending a lot of time with because we were doing a lot of, have been making fun of me for saying pod. They keep calling, because we call it the pod. They say podcast, and every time we say pod, they apparently cringe. So I'm just going to say pod three times, pod, to make my sisters cringe.
I would say that is a the polite term is meticulous form of criticism. to Nagon sisters, relax. Just chill.
Oh, you've just inflamed an already inflamed situation. More importantly, thanks to everybody for listening this season, and particularly to big thanks to both of you. You know, I don't know if I say thanks to Dan and Adam
both. It's great
for coming
fun.
And putting up with me, and especially this past week because I've had a bit of a family issue that I haven't been around, and you did the interview all on your own. Big thanks also to our wonderful colleagues at the Free Press, Paul Simin, editor, Wendy Swatsky, who does the digital work over there. And big thanks to you, Adam, over here at CJNU, all the staff here.
It is my pleasure because doing this is fun. We get to, I think the line you used once, Dan, is we take all of our guests incredibly seriously, but we do not take ourselves seriously at all.
I believe that having been, proportionally speaking, more the butt of jokes than any other person on the podcast, I believe that I can say that with complete authority. So
me wetch, everybody. Thanks very much.
Thank you.